Kung Hei Fat Choi. Hello, thank you for taking time to download and listen to podcast from Sayota Underground on them. I'm Harry Brady Jr. Podcast number 249.
We got it together, didn't we? We've definitely got our thing together, don't we?
So as my four-year-old reminded me, a belated Happy New Year to any of our Chinese listeners. Celtic are now playing some fantastic football. The recent victory over Aberdeen was superb. First half we played like a team who'd come back at 3 o'clock on Friday morning from Milan. In the second half we just blew them away. We've got the St Johnstone game coming up as I record this tomorrow night. So I'm looking forward to going and watch Celtic as I've never looked forward for quite some time. I talked on last week's podcast about the few remaining places at the inaugural Celtic FC Foundation Golf Day, and from speaking with people today, I think there are still one or two places left for four balls at £400 each. There's also, you can take along guests to the dinner and a prize and auction event which is taking place afterwards. The Celtic FC Foundation Golf Day is taking place at Renfrew Golf Club on Thursday, 2nd of April, with proceeds raised going towards a project that will help children and young people with autism. In collaboration with the University of Strathclyde, the Foundation intend to create a project which will offer an opportunity to enhance each child's well-being through supported physical activity such as football, dance and focus on fun. If you don't know much about autism, I would suggest that you go online to see how important a project like this can be. What's particularly great about this is that Celtic are working in the local community on a project for people faced with the challenges of autism, and the Golf Day itself is happening on World Autism Awareness Day, which is a day designated by the United Nations to promote awareness and understanding of autism. If you want to know anything about autism or anything about the project, or if you want to participate in the Golf Day or go along to the event or want to know about any of the prizes, whatever, just email cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk. That's cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk or telephone 0141 551 4291. 0141 551 4291. But Celtic FC Foundation events are not all about fundraising for other people. They also work on projects which is about helping yourself, and one of those is the football fans in training, the female football fans in training, I should say. It is a 13-week programme delivered at Celtic Park in collaboration with the Scottish Professional Football League Trust and the Foundation. It's to encourage female supporters, 35 to 65, to make significant changes to their risk of ill health by losing weight, becoming more active and eating a healthier diet. Participants are targeted to achieve 5 to 10% reduction in body weight whilst improving fitness levels. There's coaches on hand. Each session lasts for approximately 2 hours, comprised of 1 hour interactive workshop hosted in one of the matchday lounges. The criteria are female only, age 35 to 65, BMI of 28 or above. It's on Wednesday evenings, 6 to 8, 25th of March to the 17th of June. It's tailored around the individual. If you are a female and you're interested, again, CFC Foundation at celticfc.co.uk or 0141 551 4291. This week's podcast is a discussion between our own St Anthony and Celtic author Michael Tierney. You may know him from the book The First Game With My Father. It's a great chat between the two, discussing many things, books and Celtic. I think Sean Connery, Gerard Butler and others get name checks in this. So, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady. That was Harry Brady Jr. This is St Anthony with him, Michael Tierney.
It's my great pleasure to be joined tonight by the author Michael Tierney of the excellent book The First Game With My Father. First of all, I'm going to apologise to Michael because I meant to have this podcast a long time ago and due to a variety of reasons we never get around to it, but I'm absolutely delighted to be able to have Michael here today. So as always, with the tradition of the Celtic Underground podcasts, the first question is always, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
first Celtic game. Now, the book's called The First Game With My Father, it wasn't just the first game with my father. It was actually the first game I'd ever been to as a Celtic fan, even though I was 15. So, and I've made a point of looking at the book because I knew you were going to ask me that, and I thought, I'm going to get this wrong unless I've got it written down, the exact dates. So it was UEFA Cup second round, second leg, Celtic versus Sporting Lisbon, Wednesday, 2nd November, 1983, kick off at 7:30. And part of the reason it was the first game, and that's really what I look at in the book, was we were from a family of nine kids, big family, and my folks never really had that much money, to be honest. You know, I'm not pleading terrible poverty, but never really had the money to go to any games, and I kind of suddenly woke up one day at 15 thinking, I've never been to a football match. You know, I've watched Celtic on the telly, I've listened to it on the radio with my dad, but we've never actually been. So sort of one day out of the blue, one of his pals pulled a couple of tickets appeared with four tickets actually.
Not for the stand?
For a stand.
You need seats?
No, not at all. George from down the pub, down in Quinns, gave my dad a ticket for myself, my brother Ian, George and my dad. So that was the first Celtic game I'd ever been to, age 15. So it was the first game I'd been to, but it was also the first game of my dad as well.
Mm-hmm. So that must have left a big impression on you.
Oh, I mean, that was, you know, as I say, all your pals are going to matches and stuff, and I'm desperate to go to a game, my brother's desperate to go to a game, there's four boys, there's five girls. Girls weren't that fussed about the football, but we're desperate to go to the games. And I just remember it so well. It was like channeling the Chocolate Factory, you know. You get presented with a golden ticket. My dad came up to the loft one night and, you know, started talking about the football and talking about this and the next thing, then passed over the ticket. So we were over the moon. So my dad had an old Volkswagen van, an old white Volkswagen, and we headed off through Springburn and away into the town, and we were just overjoyed. It was a fantastic night, you know, my memories of the game, I mean, it was just noise, just a wall of noise. I'm going to try and remember the goals in the right order, and you'll definitely correct me if I'm wrong. Tommy Burns, Tam McAdam, Brian McClure, Murder McLeod and Frank McGarvey. Is that right? Right order.
There was something special about it. I think when you're younger, something about a night game and the floodlights. It's definitely a different experience for a daytime game.
You know, it's funny because, and that was being my first game, but people always talk about the Saturday afternoon and the 3 o'clock kickoff, which is fantastic. Mm. But going to that game in a kind of cold November, and you know, I can smell the chips. I can smell us going over there in the diesel and the chips, and it's a dark night, and you know, you're just getting to the ground and you can hear the noise and you've got floodlights, and it just added to everything, the whole atmosphere of the occasion.
Celtic Park was wonderful because it didn't matter how far away you were, the floodlights stood at a mile. They were so, they just went right up to the sky.
That's right. It was a big alien spaceship there.
Stood out for miles.
Aye. I mean, they literally looked like just big giant light spotlights done on the cheap. But no, you're right. I mean, that kind of night game was fantastic, and that was me. You know, you're hooked. And I remember at the end of it, we were so excited. My dad was, you know, he was getting us up the road and stuff, and me and my brother Ian talking about how that was us. We wanted to go and see more games. And said to my dad that there was a Rangers game at the weekend and could we go to that? And of course he said yes, but kind of deep down we knew we probably wouldn't because, as I said, they never had that much money. And it ended up that was the first game with my dad. Mm-hmm. And it, through various reasons, and we could maybe get into later, or I don't know what order you want to do things in, but that was the first and that was the last game with my dad, until 30 years later.
Well, one of the questions I've got is, like, your dad was obviously really chuffed about the... I mean, to pick your first game to go to, I mean, does he get any better than that, really?
Yeah,
That was an oasis in the desert of European games for maybe 10 years. The one that everybody remembers and stands at a mile. But your dad never had the desire. It was almost as if your dad thought that couldn't be beaten.
Well, do you know what? In some ways, he never really chose the game. You know, it was George, it was George who got the tickets. But my dad was you know, he was a Celtic fan, I would say, from afar, as it were. You know, he'd went to games with his brother-in-laws. His brother wasn't here, his brother was down in England. Went to a few games, but come from a big family, his priority was the kids and stuff. And but he listened to it all the time, and it didn't matter to him so much that if he didn't actually go on a Saturday or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the point of him, it wasn't the point of football, or at least it wasn't the point of Celtic. For him, it was, it didn't matter if you went to a match, as long as you supported the team, as long as you were part of, you know, that phrase, the Celtic family, whether you're watching it on the telly or you're listening to it on the radio, Radio Clyde, as we always used to listen to, because he was always busy in the house doing stuff and doing something and fixing something. So actually attending the matches, people talk about how important it is, and of course it's important, I think it's really important, but for my dad it wasn't the be all and end all, and I never grew up that way. It was just, if you support the team, if you're part of the kind of the culture of Celtic, the family of Celtic, what Celtic means, it means you don't need to be there. You just, no matter where you are in the world, you're in America, in Australia, you could be in South Africa or whatever, you're just part of that family, and you know that you'll always look out or listen out for the results. So that was the important thing for him, not just going to the games, just being part of it, you know what I mean? And that kind of, I suppose for us, although of course the boys, as we got older, we went to matches and stuff, but I used to love just being, you know, growing up in the house, listening to my mum, listening to the radio. She'd be going mad more than my dad was, you know, listening to the radio, and see, the nine of us, we'd all be in the house listening, and that was part of it, that was part of the story.
Radio's a part of what we're upbringing as well, because as boys, there wasn't a great TV coverage, so it was radio.
Exactly.
Now, my dad took me to home games, right, but it wasn't, he would go to Motherwell, he would go to Kilmarnock, but if it was Dundee, Aberdeen, maybe even Edinburgh, he wouldn't be fussing. He also worked at times, so when I was of school age, I didn't really get to those games a great deal. I always remember listening to especially Radio Clyde, and they would say, there's been a goal at Easter Road, and you're like, oh God, no. And then for about 5 seconds, and you could, sometimes you get a wee, if you could hear the crowd, you get a wee inkling if it was us.
That's right, that's right.
You might hear the fans go,
that's right.
And you think, yes, we've got a goal. But your heart would sink, you know, the nerves would kick in.
Absolutely.
So it's a different experience.
It was a different experience, but in some ways, you know, I loved it, because I used to listen to my dad as well to the boxing and things like that on the radio. As you say, it was a different experience, a different medium for communicating. So, you know, you couldn't just quickly watch the telly or whatever. You just, that listening, you couldn't see anything. You had to imagine it. The commentator had to be good. You listened for clues in his voice. Is it Celtic? Are they in defence? Are they in attack? Just now, you don't know quite what's happening. And I loved that. I just loved hearing that kind of way of relaying a story to you, you know. So, as I say, going to the matches was important. Me and my brothers went later on and stuff. You went with your pals, but we kind of mostly grew up on, I suppose in some ways as well, young boys, you played football. You know, we actually played football on Saturdays. And for me, I was obsessed with playing football. So actually going to the games was secondary at a certain age. You know, the priority was play football. And my dad made sure we played football first, and, you know, you catch the football after. You'll always get the highlights, you know, that was it.
Bill, who would be your hero that period? Because you quite a few to choose for.
Yeah, well, I'd have to say it was, and it probably maybe same for everyone. I'm 46 now, but it was Kenny Dalglish, you know. And again, the funny thing at that time was that you saw highlights of Kenny. You didn't go to all the games, but there was just something about Kenny, you know. There was just something that, for me, was encapsulated. It was almost like he'd, Kenny, it became, I think, almost the first, at least in Scotland anyway, almost like a superstar, like a pop star.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the Lions, the Lisbon Lions, and they were incredible, but they were our father's generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were the short back and size brigade, you know, they were neat and sharp and cool. But then kind of Celtic, they came in with the College Street gang with the long hair and the sideburns a wee bit, and Kerry with his long blonde hair and stuff. And so he was my hero. And I don't know if this is making any sense to do this, but I was going to read a wee bit about Kenny because it kind of, I suppose it encapsulates really Kenny, you know, what I kind of thought about him. So, or I'll try and find it. It's not too long, but I'll read this wee bit from the book. The games never bothered my parents, although now and again my mother would look askance when the strip of land at the bottom of the garden began to resemble a turnip field. When the boys played football, Ian was Frank McGarvey, Mark was Paddy Bonner, he was the only one with goalie gloves, so he had little choice in the matter, and Vincent was too young to care. Me, I stood in the garden wearing a second-hand Celtic strip and Celtic sweatbands on my wrists. I wore the same Celtic strip for years and it stretched across my chest like a sausage skin. I had flash new Adidas football boots from Rovers on my feet. My parents never skimped on my football boots and I was as happy as could be. I was always playing for Celtic. I was Kenny Dalglish, King Kenny. Kenny, always just Kenny. It didn't matter that he had swapped his Celtic shirt for a Liverpool jersey. I was always Kenny. If Celtic was in my childhood DNA, then Kenny Dalglish was the most dominant strand of that particular genetic football structure. Growing up in Glasgow, there were few boys who didn't want to be like Kenny, regardless of the colour of the shirt they wore. He was one of those few select players whose first name sufficed, and he played the game the way every boy dreamed about. He was faultless as my grandmother's old clock. If you wanted to score a goal in your dreams, it would always be the kind Kenny scored. Arms wide apart, the hands hanging loosely from his limbs, perfect balance, right foot swinging back and the left anchored to the ground. Open spot in the goal, don't even look up. Devastating, simple. That was Kenny. I can do a lot more, but you know, it's just...
Well, I think for younger listeners, the way we would describe it is he was Larson for that for a period.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the kids that grew up adoring Henrik,
yeah,
and you're right there about the first name. It's never Larson. It's like Henrik.
It's just
and that was Kenny 40 years ago. You know. Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember I was working on something for somebody. It was a project. It was about Celtic actually, and it was about Kenny. It was a Celtic opus, and I was writing a piece on Kenny, and it was my reflections on Kenny. And actually, I spoke to Graham Souness, you know, about what he thought of Kenny. I spoke to a couple of people, but I remember Souness in particular saying that he said he was in awe of Kenny. He just said that Kenny was there was a time in Kenny's career. I think it was just when he was at Liverpool, obviously that's when he was playing with them. He said that Kenny Dalglish was the best player in the world. And, you know, to think that I was a Celtic player, he said at the time, you know, he was better than Platini and Rummenigge and this, that and the next thing. The best player in the world.
Well, I was 11 when he left in 77, and again, it's funny the things you remember. And I always remember my dad woke me up, I'm sure it was the school holidays. My dad woke me up and he said, "You need to go up and see this." And it's about 7:30 in the morning. My dad worked in the Govan shipyard, so he's going out early at his work. And I was a bit sort of like, "What's going on here?" And he showed me the newspaper and it showed you Kenny signing for Liverpool with Bob Paisley and the Liverpool chairman. And the big headlines, 440,000, Dalglish goes to Anfield. And I actually think my dad was so disappointed he wanted somebody to talk to. I'm an only child, right? So my mother's no interested. And the two of us, in those early years, Kenny, Danny McGrain were the real Celtic talents. And the disappointment was etched in my dad's face. And I remember running back into the room, jumped up in the bed and ripped the posters after the ball. And years later, passing, and me and my wife were dating at the time, they were late 80s. And I can't even remember the whiskey advert, but you might recall it yourself. There was a whiskey advert in the movies, in the cinema. And the joke was that Scotland has lost all of its natural resources. The Stone of Destiny, Bonnie Prince Charlie, North Sea Oil, and the funny part of them is I'm Kenny Dalglish, and I used to swim in the seats of that cinema, and it was like somebody twisted a knife in me. Because Scotland didn't lose Kenny Dalglish, we lost Kenny Dalglish.
That's right.
He still
came
for the games at Hampden. He still gave the Scotland fans great memories.
That's right.
But every time that advert came on, that it just killed me.
Well, if I remember correctly, and I think it was, because was Kenny left or? He either left or he signed on the same day
Elvis.
As Elvis died.
That was a joke, the king's gone.
And that was it, because my dad was a huge Elvis fan. And you know, so that was the death of two kings, you know, and it was I just remember that so well, you know. Mm-hmm. And even at the time, you know, saying that you never saw Kenny playing that much, you heard him about him on the radio or the highlights and stuff, but you just knew there was something spectacular, because other men were really moved by the fact. Celtic men were moved by the fact that Kenny was gone. Of course,
and men were hard-working men. I don't mean that in an aggressive way, but they were hard-working men. They were the guys who showed a sensitive side.
No, that's
so,
right.
And so my dad was the same. But when you mention Kenny, his eyes lit up and he loved it. And sort
that's
of,
right.
You know, everything made him happy.
Oh no. Kenny was, and it was interesting because. Well, see, I grew up originally in Partick, but then we moved here to Bishop Briggs, and then over the back of Bishop Briggs is Milton, and that's where Kenny grew up, you know. Obviously he'd moved away, but you know, I said we used to pretend that Kenny used to play over the back of the quarry, so Kenny was the kind of hero back then. I would try and think that probably after that would be Charlie Nick, I think Charlie was everybody's hero. He was the boy band hero, you know. He's moved again, another generation gone from the Lions.
Well, he was the first player that I remember my dad couldn't take to, and I don't mean that as a footballer. My dad adored him, but see that the sort of the playboy and
the flash, it was too much for that generation.
And the haircut was the way it should be, and I'm of that age roughly. And there came a point, the only thing me and my dad had in common was Celtic. Because he didn't like the music I listened to, he didn't like the clothes I was wearing, and he didn't like the haircuts I was getting. So the wee common denominator that went between us was Celtic. But that leads us on to the question, how did the idea of the book come around?
Okay, as I say, you know, it was the first game of my father, so that was years ago. And then in 2002, my father had a stroke, and it was a really bad stroke. You know, he lives nearby, and he, so that's 13 years ago, rendered him unable to walk or talk at all, you know. So basically 13 years, that's been his whole situation. So it's been a really difficult time. So a few years ago, you know, you're reflecting on things, and within that time, you know, I've not really been able to have a conversation with my dad, you know, because he can't talk back. You know, I can talk to him, but he can't talk back. So a lot of things were in my mind, thinking, oh, it's God, time's flying. And then it struck me that, my God, it's been almost 30 years since we'd gone to that game, because I started writing the book2013, so that's, you know, just over a year ago. So I had written a piece for Celtic Opus again. It was about an experience with your father, so I wrote about my dad, and it'd always been in my head, that kind of seed of, you know, I'd only been to that one game with my dad. As I say, just life gets in the way, he does these things, blah blah blah, and we do ours. So it was coming up to 30 years since the first game, I thought, and my dad's not well, and I thought, do you know, I would love to take him back to Celtic Park, even though, you know, his health isn't good, and not necessarily experience it in a great way, in a wheelchair and stuff. So I thought, you know, that'd be fantastic, take my dad back 30 years later. And then it started to go around, well, I've written a piece about him, 30 years, what's happened in those 30 years? My dad had a stroke, everyone's grown up and had kids and this, that, next thing. So then that kind of came together. I thought, you know, that's quite a nice idea, that if I start off, I do a starting off about the game that went with my father, and then eventually will end on going, taking them to another match. But then what happened to us in between? And it became about, you know, Celtic, about community, about identity, about culture, about memory, about who we are, and about fathers, and specifically kind of, although it does relate to Celtic, of course, but I would say maybe more typical, it's kind of working class men, working class fathers, and how they are with their sons and what they pass on to them, and they pass on good things, sometimes they pass on bad things. So it was, I just wanted to discover all that, because my dad was silent for 12 years, or still silent for 12 years, and he wasn't able to talk politics, which he did every single day of the week, you know. He talked about football, Celtic, this, that, next thing. But then when that went silent, I wanted to fill in that gap. So that was really how it all came about. Me just wanting to join the dots from A to Z, you know. Went to the game and we'll go back. So it turned out, I actually wanted to take him to a Champions League game, because the first game had been a European game, and I'll take him to a Champions League game. So I looked into it, and for whatever reason, more I think to do with myself, my mum said, look, it's going to be difficult at night time, game, this, that, next thing. I said, okay. So I kind of just thought, right, it's got to be a game in November, 30 years roughly to the...
Cemetery, perfect
sense. Yeah, it's just got to be roughly, you know, get me to the 30 years, as near as I can to that game. And I just found a game. It was the 2nd of November. It was against Dundee United, so it was exactly, not even a day out, it was exactly 30 years to the game. So it was brilliant, so it was perfect. So
what was the score?
Oh, God. I think it was 2-0 to Celtic.
Well, it's Gillies by one.
God, do you know, I need to check that.
No. I can tell you the score for 30 years ago, and if I tell you the score for the last
one. But so that was it. So I took him to that game, and it was great. I took my brother, who'd been with us the first time round. And I didn't take George, because George lives in Ireland now. I took my daughter. I had the chance that I could have taken my boys, but I kind of wanted to mix it up a little bit. Take my girl, take her home. So that was that.
So the way I would describe the book is, it's autobiographical of yourself, because you're basically telling your life.
Aye.
But it also tells your dad's life.
Aye.
And there was the one thing that strikes... The way I would describe it is, you bared your soul. Because not only are you telling your own life, but you're telling your dad's life, and as you said, you're filling in dots as well. And there's a bit in it that you keep coming back to. It was the fact that your dad's dad died during the Second World War.
That's right.
And you never really got to know him, and that's really sad.
Yeah, it's something that, I put a bit of context, I think, my father's... hinterland, his heritage, obviously it goes back to Ireland and stuff, and family had all, whatever generation, moved over. He lived in Maryhill. So his father was the Second World War, so my dad was only, I think, one when my grandfather went away to war. His name was Michael as well. So he was killed in France. So my dad didn't know his father, some photographs, things like that. But I always felt there was a huge void in my dad's life about his father, because he wanted to know who he was, but he never really had anything. He had stories about his father and where his father came from, and the Quins and the Mahonies and the Tierneys in Ireland. But I think my dad felt cheated a wee bit not having his father. So I was kind of trying to, I wanted to fill in the gaps. I wanted to find my grandfather for him. I wanted to find out the story about my grandfather, because my dad would never be able to do it now, you know, because of his illness. So I wanted to find my grandfather's story with him in order to fill in the gaps for myself and my father. So the whole thing became this whole thing, very autobiographical, but about identity and about who we are and where we're from and what it means. And, you know, a lot of us have that kind of Irish hinterland, so I wanted to explore that a wee bit more. And you find out there's a lot of truths and some things you've been told, and a lot of things that aren't as true as you maybe thought. And for me, it was a fantastic kind of self-discovery into trying to find out a bit more about me, and also obviously my father, and if it was all true or not, because there was a few things that didn't quite marry up. But yeah, so for me, it was through my dad's story, through my grandfather's story, it was a great way of finding out about us.
The other thing I would say about the book that comes across is, and I can relate to this a wee bit, is a house is, it's the home, right? But that house plays such a part in that book.
Aye.
The bit that you described, the first day your dad was there, right? Was it snowing?
That's right, it's snowing.
And you saw it, and it's a, you've got a big family, so obviously you need a bigger house.
Yeah.
And your dad was just obsessed about getting this house.
Aye.
And nothing would do, but he had to get it.
Well.
And even when you describe that how he did the odd jobs about the house, and that you portray a very happy child to it, all the kids running in and out playing in the garden,
aye,
and the quarry thing at the back, and your pals would all come to your house, and I don't think people appreciate somehow, like, the way I would describe it is, the first 14 years of my life were spent in a wee flat in Govan,
aye,
a wee low-down flat in a close, and my dad's doctor's surgery is in that street,
aye,
and every time I take my dad to the doctor's, which is getting increasingly more these days because he's getting older, we pass by the old house, and there's never a day goes by or a time goes by I don't look at that,
I know,
and something comes back into my mind that I forgot about.
That's right.
It could be a relation that's passed on. It can be a birthday party, a happy occasion, a Christmas. But something, and to be honest, it's not a very desirable area now.
Aye.
But that there's a part of me in that house will always be in that house.
And it will always be there, Steve.
And I think people can relate to that, anybody who's got that experience.
Aye. Well, I think, I mean, you know, again, touching on the happy childhood, and sometimes you can look back and you think, oh, you know, am I making that up? Am I glossing up? Actually, no, because it was just a brilliant childhood. And we grew up initially in Partick, you know, we were in a flat. I think at the time, there was six, my mum and dad had six kids. And then they had even more when we got to Bishop Briggs. But at the time, so we lived in a small flat, very cramped. And my mother was from one of 12, so a big family there. And I'd say there wasn't that much money going around. But for whatever reason, you know, my dad was a great handyman, great stuff. So we lived in Partick, but he'd came across this house in Bishop Briggs. And to be honest with you, the house was just amazing. It's an amazing big house, big, big house. Mm. But one of these streets where people always say, get the worst house in the best street. Well, that's what it was, because you got it cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in a brilliant street, but it needed everything done. To it. But it was huge, and the garden was literally, you know, no exaggeration, the size of a football pitch. So you're wheeling in 6 to 9 kids, you know, and the house just became everybody in the street, every kid, you know, 20 kids in the street, that's where they played football, boys and girls, round the back. My dad was always fixing things. It took him the best part of 20 years to fix the house up, you know, but there was so much happiness in that house. And for me, as the story was developing, or at least when I'd been thinking about it before, the house also put a lot of pressure on my dad, because he had to fix things and do this and do that, as well as work and raise 9 kids, and a lot of pressure on my mum as well. And part of me thinks that led to his stroke, you know, it was the pressure that led to it. And it's just interesting that obviously the stroke, and he had his cerebral hemorrhage, so it's, in his brain, and he got part of his skull cut out. Had to take that out to relieve the pressure. And they never replaced it. But it was funny, because after my dad had a stroke, and you know, he was 6 months in hospital, and then we got him home, and things were different then in the house. You know, we were just talking about how important the house is. He was no longer fixing things. He was no longer doing things. We were starting to take care of him. My mother was taking care of him. I moved back to Bishop Briggs to take care of him. My sisters moved back as well. Started to clear out a lot of his old stuff, because he was a hell of a hoarder. He got a right old roll of rubbish he used to keep, you know. But it was always kept up in the loft. Now, we used to sleep up in the loft, and the loft was brilliant. And we had loads of space. But over the years, my dad put everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the loft was like a mirror of his head. It was so full of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, his head exploded, because the loft was exploding. It was filled with all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, long story short, you know, we cleared it out, and my dad got better. And then, about 2 or 3 years after his illness, the stroke, and bear in mind, he can't walk or talk, we eventually get round to getting a new roof on, getting it re-roofed. Mm-hmm. We wanted it re-roofed. And And so when the roof got fixed...
This is Jerry the roofer?
Jerry the roofer. Right. Jerry was just an old guy, a friend of a friend, an Irish guy, lovely guy. Lovely guy who, I think, all his lotteries came at once when he got that job, because he got a few bob, and I don't know how much Her Majesty's tax man saw, you know. But Jerry was...
Is there a little bit of bobs as you're listening?
And Jerry was just a lovely guy. He was a type of guy. My dad was wary of people coming into his house. It was into his territory.
Mm-hmm.
But we got this roof fixed, and Jerry spent so much time, like a work of art, he spent so much time on it. Mm-hmm. We looked after him, blah, blah, blah. But then that was it. The house is fixed. And it was almost like a mirror. As my dad was getting fixed, mm-hmm. and his head was getting fixed, the house was getting fixed, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And the house just kind of came back to life a bit, and my dad slowly but surely getting better. So the house played a massive part in our lives. It was a place that it took us out of a wee flat in Partick, and you know, if four boys and five girls grew up in Partick, it might be quite tough for them, mm-hmm. you know. We came here, and you know, he got us here, and as I say, just a great place, great community, and a great family atmosphere, environment.
Definitely comes across.
He encouraged, you know, that was his thing. His thing was your family. It's your family first and foremost, you know. And again, go back to that Celtic thing, almost mirroring this kind of, you know, community, and that anyone can be part of your community. You know, if it's, you know, we don't discriminate, you know, for any reason, but you're all welcome into this family, mm-hmm. and that's what it was like. So yeah.
So your mum and dad were quite a pair in terms of the fact that your dad, although your dad wasn't Irish, he had an Irish nationalist perspective.
Aye.
But your mum coming for the islands, a more Aye. Gentle background.
Aye.
And she still spoke Gaelic on other
right.
occasions.
That's right.
So the contrast between the two of them in the book is very interesting as well.
Yeah, you know, see, my dad, his father, they're all second, you know, generation Irish. As I say, Cork, Tyrone, and that was both sides of my dad's family, on my grandmother's side and grandfather's side. But on my mother's side, mm-hmm. They were all from Barra, and big family up there. Mother used to speak Gaelic and all that, but my dad loved it. He wished he could speak it, and she always gave him into trouble. She always spoke it all the time. But he loved that sense of identity of who we were, because Barra's a real good Celtic stronghold, as it were, you know. And but they were different in that regard, you know. One's kind of Irish, the other's got the real Scottish heritage, hinterland. But I kind of grew up more with my father's, you know. You grew up that way, and he identified through his kind of heritage, Celtic and Ireland and this, that, next thing. And I suppose, to the detriment of my mother's, we never really explored it enough. Although we used to go to Barra every single summer, my dad loved going up, but it was always Ireland this and Ireland that, but we never really explored it. But once my father had a stroke, I began to look a wee bit more into the Barra side of things,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
My mother's side, which was very important. But no, they had a brilliant dynamic. I mean, probably people would say now it was very old fashioned. It was my mother looked after the house. I mean, she did everything. I mean, you know, the cooking, the cleaning, and the washing, blah blah blah. But very much regimented. 9 kids, everyone, their shoes were ready, their uniforms were washed and ironed. My dad did the work, he was the man of the house, kind of thing. Wasn't always working, it was tough, but he was always there. You know, one thing my father, he never had a lot of money, but he was always there. I mean, he was just always there for us, for the boys, for the girls, you know, and that's what I got from him. That's what I remember so fondly, although he's not gone, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
Growing up, that was it. It was my dad was always there, kind of thing, you know.
So, talking more about yourself now, when you were a teenager, you had the opportunity to sign for Morton. Now, this is at a time when Morton had a rare team. They were an SPL team. They were regularly taking on the thing that people of the time remember is Aberdeen couldn't beat Morton. It used to be Alec Ferguson's bogey team.
Aye.
And every time it seemed to go down to Grey, they could beat Celtic and Rangers, but they could never beat Morton.
Aye.
So they've got a cracking team at the time. Benny Rooney and Mike Jackson. Two ex-Celtic men are the manager and assistant manager, and for some reason they wanted you to sign, and you turned them down.
Well, thanks for saying for some reason.
But I mean, if everyone's ambition to be a footballer, and well, it can allow you to play
because it was good. Oh, my kid. No, no. yeah, I mean, I think I was, I'm trying to remember, I think I was 15 at the time. I was a pretty fair player, you know, at the time. God, I think probably everyone thinks they were, you know. I was good. I had trials with Middlesbrough, St Johnstone, Dundee, Partick Thistle, who else was it down at? I think it was down at Man City, and Morton. But at the time with, I think it was at 15, with Benny Rooney and Mike Jackson came to the house. And that was great, you know, because my brothers and sisters thought we were going to be millionaires, you know. And I think they came, so the two of them came round the house and my mum got the good plates out and stuff and a nice cup of tea and a biscuits and all that, you know, and to sign for them. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think they were basically saying, you know, you'll get a couple of pair of football boots, 15 at the time, so you'd be signing, you'd be nearly 16, and you know, I think they said you'd maybe get 30 quid or something quietly. You know, you get travel expenses, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because it wasn't professional forms, it was just, I don't know if it was, whatever, I can't remember. But, yeah, you know, so for me that was amazing. But my dad had kind of, he sat down with him and it was all left to him. My dad said, no, it's entirely up to yourself. So I get brought in the room, and my dad asked Benny and Mike Jackson to go through the whole spiel again. I think they thought they were just going to tell my dad what was going to happen, kind of thing, and then he would just tell me, well, Rich, you sign it for Morton, you know. But so when they went through it again and I had to think about it, and I think at the time, you know, there was a couple of things on the go. People were maybe coming down and see us in trials with different people, and for whatever reason, I can't really remember why, but I never signed. And you know, Maybe I wasn't good enough. I think I was at the time, but something held me back from really committing to a team. You know, like I was up at Dundee, I'm sure it was Jockey Scott and Archie Knox that were up there. And I used to play, well, I started out as a forward and then midfield. For some reason they had me down as a left back and I thought, no chance, I'll not be a left back for anybody. Which was just being a boy, you know, because, you know, the only thing you want to do is score goals, really. I remember him being up there, I think he'd offered me a year YTS. And that's at age 16, 17, and you're thinking, you know, it's not very much. You know, 2 years maybe might be okay, you get to 18, but a year, I'm not sure about that. And, you know, and then I started to think of things like, you know, going to college or uni or whatever, or even going out working with my dad and stuff like that. And I don't, you know, sometimes maybe you just fall away from things, you know.
Do you regret it?
No, I honestly, I couldn't say I regret it. I mean, the only thing is I'm curious as to how it would have turned out. Because I was a good player. So I'm curious to know that, you know, if I'd got to 18, 19 and, yeah, you were holding down, maybe you did go to Morton and maybe you moved on or whatever. But I'd like to think that I could have done okay, but I think regret would be too strong a word, because I don't think we should regret the things.
No. You know, there's an old saying, which for you does it get by you?
Aye, no, I don't regret it, but I'm just curious. I'd love to have known. I'd love to be able to go back now and just think, say to that, hey, give it a bash, you know, maybe take a year and see if you can step up from boys' football to men's football type thing. But, you know.
Well, you did go to college, university, whatever, and you became a journalist.
Aye.
Which is obviously comes in handy when you're writing a book. The other thing that fascinated me in there was the story with the Washington Post.
Well, that was, my dates, I'm trying to think that'd be 2000, and it was the summer before my dad had a stroke. So there was a thing called the Lawrence Stern Fellowship. It's basically a fellowship with a 3-month fellowship with the Washington Post. and I applied for it. But it turns out I never got it in the end. I was short. I think I was the only one in Scotland at the time I was down there. Mostly it was papers. It was the Financial Times, the Guardian, whatever papers like that. So I was delighted that I'd been shortlisted. I remember going down to London and I'd been over in Libya and I'd done stories in Colonel Gaddafi and I'd done some stuff in Ireland and things like that. And I met the famous, most famous editor in the world. I think one of probably the best editors of his time, Ben Bradley of the Washington Post. So I was interviewed by him and a couple of others. And it was quite funny because he got on to talking about, one of them was talking about, again, it was about identity and who you were. And he asked me to describe myself. And I think it was, I was working class, Catholic and Scottish. And they were quite intrigued as to why I was Scottish third. They didn't say, I didn't say I was Scottish, what class. And it was because I didn't really feel that they were as big a thing for me as being working class and a young Catholic boy. That had formed my identity as opposed to the country I lived in. It was more the environment, the class around me, the people around me and the religion I had brought up in. So we kind of were discussing that with Bradley at the Washington Post. And I think I actually brought up the Scottish Cup final for some reason. I don't know how I got into it, but talking about was it 1980 with the horses?
The right. 1980.
And for some reason I started bringing all this up and I'm thinking, so maybe that was it, maybe that was why I never got the fellowship, but no, I don't think it was. Probably.
You can't imagine the Super Bowl final.
No.
Somehow I'm not that clued up in American football, but the Redskins or whatever it is, fans invading the park, the Green Bay Packers or something like that,
chased by the police. No, it was just going back to that whole thing about identity and who we were and stuff. But for me, it was a fantastic experience to go down to meet Ben Bradley, who had admired from afar from Watergate. As a young journalist, I would love to have gone over there, but I never got it. But it was interesting because some of the I think it was seven other candidates, obviously one got it, and we all received letters saying, sorry to commiserate with you that you never got it. I think it was from the bureau chief, but I actually got one from Bradley himself, and I checked with the other ones. I think I was the only one that got a letter from Bradley.
A personal one,
and it was great because it was commiserating with me that I never got it, and that he said that I was at a stage in my career where I should ply my trade in Washington, and that I was a journalist he'd be proud to work with. So for me, that was me made. I didn't actually have to go to Washington. I was just delighted that somebody of Ben Bradley's stature had thought to take the time to write my personal letter. So that was Washington. And then he'd actually said, think about next year. And then next year, my father had a stroke. Mm-hmm. So, things changed enormously for me then from a work perspective as well. I moved back to Bishopbriggs here because I travelled an awful lot with my job and stuff. And it changed a lot, from then on. But no,
Well, talking about the travelling then, because there's a bit in the book that you describe how you went to, was it Bosnia? With your dad and the charity van.
That's right.
And that became less your adventure, more his adventure. Because he was more, how can I describe it, my dad's the same. Although they're more experienced in life,
that's right.
They don't have the experience of travel.
That's right. It was that generation that never really travelled, and maybe they'd go on a wee trip to Spain or something here and there. But even then, they never really did. In fact, my brother had it was a school raffle or something, and amazingly, my brother won a trip to Spain, and it was. Very quickly, my parents had gone on a trip to Spain. My brother never went with my mum and dad, so that was their first holiday. So you're right, they never really travelled. And I was only a young journalist at the time, or getting into journalism at the time, and I had gone to Croatia to go to Bosnia. It's off the top of my head, might have been 2000 and oh, I can't even remember. No, sorry, 1994 or something. I'd gone one trip, came back, and I was talking to my dad one time, said, look, I'm going back to more medical supplies. A friend of mine's going as well. And he started sort of asking me, you know, I'd like to go, or, you know, I'd like to go over there. And so it ended up that me, my dad, and a good friend of mine, Alan, we all headed off in this big, big old second-hand cheap truck thing with a big sign on it said Humanitarna Pomoc, I think that means humanitarian aid, and it was loaded up with medical supplies and this, that, and the next thing, and that was us. We were heading off to this war zone, you know. And it was fantastic because my dad was like, instead of, you know, you would think, well, be a bit worried about it. It took 20 years off my dad, off him, not on him. He suddenly felt young. He said he felt like a young man. You know, he was like going on an adventure. And so that was us. We drove way down to England, took the ferry over, took the van over, and just drove into Croatia. And it was just fantastic. It was just the first time I was really getting close to my dad, you know, in terms of...
Did you find that humbling experience? When you go out there and you saw the misery that it must have been
it was really sad. See, there's certain areas at the time you couldn't get into. So we had gone the year before, actually. I was with two fellow volunteers, and we'd gone there and we'd actually had an accident. We'd crashed the van and ended up, one of the girls, a nurse, Anna, and she got really badly injured and stuff. And it turned out that the people we were going to give aid to and help, they were helping us, which was really quite bizarre. We'd gone there to help them, but because we had this really bad accident, they were helping us, and a couple of the families had kind of took us in and looked after us, so that made me want to go back. It was very humbling. Went over with my dad and we were supposed to go down to,
was this Croatia or Bosnia?
Yeah, now that's what I was just going to get to. What we were going to be doing is, with my dad, you're going to Zagreb, then you're going to go to Split, and then once you're in Split, you're going to drive up to Mostar. So that was the plan.
Yeah.
The first time I'd gone there, we were in Split and we were going to get into Mostar, and we'd ran into difficulties and various things, won't get into it at all. So we never, you know, the soldier stuff, you never get right into Mostar. When I went with my dad, we were to do the same thing again. We went to Croatia, and we were kind of lost, and my dad said, look, we need to speak some here, you know, go to church, go and speak something, because there's all got a priest who'll, you know, tell you the lie of the land and what's happening. So we're going to this priest, and he basically said, look, you know, it's getting quite dangerous. Where you want to go with your medical supplies is very iffy. You've got to watch the road you're on, because it'll be, you know. So what we ended up doing was just leaving all the medical supplies with this priest and his network kind of thing. Took them on and dispersed them. But it was fantastic. It was just fantastic going with my dad. And I remember thinking we were going into Zagreb and we all started singing Hail Hail, you know. We were just arriving, the three of us in the truck, you know. But it was a great experience. It was fantastic.
So you became a successful journalist, and probably the saddest part of the book is you described some very shocking events in certain places that you went to. So was journalism what you thought it would be when you started it?
I think it was, and it's funny because I'd always been, you talk about some of these events, I kind of wanted to do these type of stories, you know. Off the top of my head, there's a lot of stories. I've been in Iraq, I've been in Gaza, I've been in Ramallah, West Bank, Liberia, Libya.
Northern Ireland as well.
There's a lot of things over there that are very tough and very difficult. I was very fortunate, and I suppose in some ways you make your own fortune. But I had a couple of good editors, really good editors on the Herald magazine, and and Mark Douglas Hume, who was in the Herald newspaper at the time, for me personally, they were great, and they kind of allowed me to do what I wanted to do. My remit was quite broad, that I could, I did stories domestically, I did locally, but also went away a lot. And for me, that was, to me, that was the journalism I wanted to do. I started off in small local newspaper, I did work in Evening Times, all that kind of thing, but I wanted to go beyond kind of Glasgow and see what was out there, because to be perfectly honest with you, it was a selfish thing.
It's a big world.
It's a big world, and you know, I didn't want to, and by the way, some of my friends who are brilliant journalists work locally, work nationally, and don't do the type of stuff that I used to do. But that's what I wanted to do, and I was aware that things might be quite difficult in various places, but that was my choice. I wanted to go and see things, because I just used to think the world's an incredible place. You know, I don't want to not see these places. I wanted to actively seek them out and find them, and you know.
I mean, do you think that in the modern age, do you see journalism changing with the new media? Because I mean, even when you think back to the early years of the century, but when you were doing it, around about the time your dad took Noel, there's been such changes in the last 10, 15 years. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, I left the Herald newspaper seven years ago. So I moved into kind of publishing stuff, and I was doing a bit of work out in the Middle East with some people and stuff. So I left the paper 7 years ago, but maybe 10 years ago it started to change. You know, there was much more social media. Now, I'll be honest, at the time, I was probably slightly resisting of that, because no one likes change. I don't care what anybody says. They don't like change. And me, you know, 10 years ago, whatever, would be, what, 36? Is that right? Yeah, 36. Around about your 30s when these things are changing, you don't like change because it's new. Mm-hmm. And if you're not comfortable with new things, you resist it, and you want to be part of the thing that you know. Mm-hmm. I would encourage any young journalist to learn new media, because I think it's fantastic. I think the idea that a journalist can write a story 10, 15 years ago, it gets printed in the paper, and however many people in Glasgow or the west of Scotland read it, there's a finite number of people who read that. Now you've got the opportunity for thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. In theory, to read your work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's absolutely fantastic, it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I wish, to some extent, I'd embraced it a wee bit more, you know. But for me at the time, I was quite traditional. I liked a newspaper, I liked a paper. This is where it should be. You should, a photographer and a writer, they should go out, a reporter, do their work, and it should be in a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So it seemed a bit strange that it would be on this line. Oh, what's this online stuff? Mm-hmm. What's this computer in my bobbery? You know?
Witchcraft. I read an article the other day that said, if you're under 35 and somebody gives you details, say a phone number, if you're under 35, you'll get your phone out and you'll key it in to your notepad or whatever it is, right? Being over 35, my first reaction would be to grab a pen and a bit of paper. It's habit, I don't know, maybe we've been programmed or whatever, but I laughed when I read that, because that's just me.
But it's true. But, you know, we're not, I wasn't a digital native, that term, you know, it's not a natural part of you, but for my kids, it's astonishing, and you know, how comfortable they are with this new media. But I think it's great, and as I say, I wish I'd embraced it a bit more, but it's incredible, you know, and so many more people can get involved in that community of, let's say, journalism, you know. Now, I have to say, sometimes a lot of people that are involved in, say, citizen journalism or things like that, they're not always the best, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think the dynamic's important, so it's important just to have that kind of dynamic, that dialogue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all for it.
So, in your time, you've met a few famous people. So, we'll run by a couple of names here. But Sean Connery, how did that come about?
Sure.
Or Tierney, to his pals.
That's right. Sean Connery. Well, when I was at the Herald, you know, I worked in the magazine, and I can't remember exactly how it happened, but there was something in the paper about Connery. I think Connery had been in touch with the editor, Mark, about, you know, maybe there's something been said about in the paper about, you know, being an exile and things like that. So he kind of almost wanted to set the record straight. So Mark said to me, look, you've got an opportunity here to interview Conrad. Now, to be fair, I was never into really, Celeb never did it for me, you know. I tried to avoid them like the plague, you know. If the person was genuinely interested, fine, but I hated that whole thing of go down to the hotel and meet someone in London for 10 minutes and, you know, about a film they're promoting. Yeah. Wasn't my thing. Connery, different ballgame. Plus, they're flying me over to his house, you know. I love a bit of that. So, myself and the photographer went out, and he was absolutely terrific. And so we'd gone along, and it was interesting the way it all started out. So we'd gone along, I was with Gordon, the photographer, terrific photographer. And but Gordon's bag was delayed at the airport for whatever reason. So we were going right to meet Connery. We thought, God, you know, we've got to be quite smart, you know, you've got to meet Connery. So I had an extra tie. So here, take that tie, you have the tie, and I've got my tie, and turned up at the door. Connery, absolutely brand new. You know, what are you doing, boys? You're all dressed up in your
finery.
You know, finery. Don't worry about that, you know, come on in and blah, blah, blah. So Gordon proceeded to tell him about his bag and how he'd not got his clothes and stuff like that. So we did our thing. We did the big interview. The interview was terrific. It went on for a wee bit and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, Connery got up and he went into this wee room at the bathroom or dressing room or whatever it was. He came out with a club shirt, a golf shirt, and a pair of shorts, you know. And he said, for Gordon, this for you, you know. So Gordon's like, so he went away into Connery's changing room to change. And then he came out, Gordon came out, and he's laughing his head off. And I said, what are you laughing at? He says, I'll tell you in a minute. So we kind of wound up with Sean, not Connery, Sean. And so we called the taxi and this, that, next thing, and I went into the taxi. I said, what are you laughing at? And Stitch is laughing. They pulled down his shorts, and he said, I've got his pants on as well. Connery gave him a big pair of his pants, so he was wearing a pair of Sean Connery's pants, which I think he's got in his wall somewhere.
What were the clean ones?
So, but no, Connery, so he was terrific. He was actually terrific. He gave us an awful lot of his time, and, you know, it was just nice. I think, what age was he? Maybe 74 at the time. He looked fantastic. He looked absolutely fantastic. Great, great storyteller. Great memories, great conversation. You know, we did our thing, but we just had a good chat, and it was nice to kind of get behind the man there. And so we actually kept in touch, and he phoned me up now and again because we had a bet on, because Connery, who kind of
this is an odd one, isn't it? You know, the jumping ship.
Yeah, a difficult one. I mean,
Connery, did he get a reason why?
Well, he did. I think at the time Connery had grown up in Edinburgh. And there's affiliation with Celtic. And so Jock Steen and this, that, next thing was part of that whole era, supporting them, probably from afar. And then, you know, a few years later, or whatever, in the 80s, and you see Connery kind of supporting Rangers. Now, if I recall correctly, I think he said it was because, I think it was during the Ferguson era, not Ferguson.
Serious?
No, not Ferguson. Fergus. Wee Fergus.
Oh, Fergus McCann.
Aye, so Wee Fergus either. I think Conor had gone along one time, and now so he says, and I don't know if it's true or not, but he said he was getting charged for getting in, that McCann was going to charge him to get in. And so I think Conor maybe took a wee bit of umbrage at that, you know. So I think Murray
heard that about him.
So Murray had heard about that and invited him along, Conrad along to the next Rangers game. So obviously they suited and booted, and they bring him in, and they, you know, the whole nine yards, give him a good day. You know, they're both Edinburgh boys and all that, and I think it kind of grew from there. So it was just, you know, from when me and Conrad were having a bit of a laugh about it, so we used to have a kind of bet about who's going to win, Celtic or Rangers, and this, that, next thing. And so I think it was a pound bet, you know, every time. But I think he owes me a few quid, you know.
You'll wait a long time.
A long time getting it. But, there was one time, it was quite funny, he'd phoned me at the office, never got him. They phoned the house one time. I'd phoned my wife and I said, look, Sean Connery, I'm coming home, but I'm going to catch him on the phone soon, so, you know. So she's upstairs and the phone rang downstairs, and but it was the answer machine, so she had planned it. She thought, I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to let him go into the answer machine, let him talk for a wee bit, and then pick it up so that I've got call reason. So she downstairs and she was waiting, but he didn't say cheerio or bye. Boom, phoned her. He talked about it.
Then he put the phone down,
so she missed it. So she went away and got the video camera, and she brings out the video camera, so she videos the phone, and she's videoing. You see this big hand coming out to press the play button, just to hear Sean Connery's voice. And then she gets her sisters round to see the video. But no, he's I find him endlessly fascinating guy, he's a character. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't big on the kind of celebrity type thing for me. It just wasn't my interest, really.
The next one is, I'm told you're a friend of King Leonidas himself, Gerard Butler.
I don't want to bum his chat. Yeah, I was at uni with Jerry, Jerry Butler we're talking about. I think the Jerry was studying law and a year younger.
The Paisley man, isn't he?
And we used to run about a wee bit, and I think we used to give out flyers together at the sub club. And I mean, he's become incredibly successful. And he always wanted to be an actor, you know. And I think he's exceeded anyone and everyone's expectations, you know, enormously. I bumped into him about three years ago, I think, in Glasgow. We caught up and we went out for had a wee night out in Glasgow. And it was great. It was just funny. I mean, it was just really funny. And we both kind of sat, you know, we're with some people in this VIP bit that he got into of this nightclub. And we sat beside him chatting, and I was just laughing, and he was laughing. He was just laughing at how successful he'd become, and it's incredible.
I know a couple of guys that are lawyers who went through the trade room to become lawyers, and they said, as a lawyer, he was a fantastic actor. Which I think he would admit himself, because that was never in it.
Well, no, I didn't. No, I don't think he really ever wanted to be a lawyer. There's a few stories about him, but how he never quite made it over the line. But I don't think we should go there. But no, incredible. I mean, you know, he's done amazing. And
So get back to the book. That there's a bit in it that I found quite powerful. Was you were in contact with Jimmy Johnson at roughly the time that he was going to die.
Yeah.
And you were portraying in the book how Agnes was looking after Jimmy.
Yeah.
And how Jimmy was himself.
Yeah.
And it was about his wee pal for school every day, coming and giving him communion. Honestly, I was nearly in tears, even.
Well, I was in tears when Agnes told me, and again, I'm just trying to remember it all, but Agnes was just absolutely brilliant. I was doing a piece for the Celtic Opus, and it was to be about Agnes. You know, I wanted this thing about, you know, somebody that was... We were doing, I think, a section on Jimmy, so you wanted to go behind it a wee bit more, you know, because you'd always get the sports guys and they would do their pieces on Jimmy, and they were far more knowledgeable than me writing about Jimmy. I wanted, who was the woman behind Jimmy? And so I went up to see her, and she was just lovely and just really wonderful. But it was great because she basically came across as such an ordinary, decent woman who knew nothing about football. And she just said, no, my man, that was my man. He just, he was a footballer. He went to work on Saturday. That was his job. He just went to work.
He could have been a plumber or a joiner.
That's what it was. And that came across, and it wasn't affected. It wasn't pretending that it was just, that was my man, wee Jimmy. And she called him Johnson, that wee bugger Johnson. Onto that wee bit you're talking about in a minute, but she told us before, and I always remember she said, aye, when it was getting bad and stuff, he always tried to go up the park. He got the park because he'd a wee jog around the park, and you know, just to keep himself going and stuff. And she had to come back and I'd, you know, shower him and look after him, this, that, next thing. But he'd been up the park and he came back, and he said, oh, Hen, I've left my teeth up the park. It's up at one of the corner flags, my false teeth. And she's like, oh, for God's sake, Johnson. She said, I went away up the park and there were a couple of wee boys there, been playing. And she said, oh, boys, you know, I'm going to help you find Jimmy's false teeth, and the wee boys were, she said they were nearly broken, you know, they were scrambling about and they found his teeth. And I went away back to the house, and he's in stitches laughing. And but it resonated with me a lot because it reminded me in some ways of my mum looking after my dad, cleaning and washing and all that stuff. And so she was very, that's what she was doing with Jimmy and towards his latter years.
But the one thing it's shown through was love.
Oh.
And it's the same with your mother and father. It just jumps out of you in the book.
Well.
And that wee short thing you put in about Jimmy and Agnes.
Yeah.
And she would have done anything for him.
Well, that was the thing. There were, you know, Jimmy was, 5 foot nothing, and Agnes is big, tall, statuesque, and so opposite. But she would do anything for him. And the way they met, again, it's off the top of my head, you know, trying to recall it, but childhood sweethearts, and she was telling us Jimmy's mum had latter years, and I can't remember, she was depression, suffering from various things and that, and she was dying, and Jimmy, who was a great singer, had gone along to, I think it was the night she died in hospital, and I can't remember her name, and it's annoying me that his wee mum's name, but she sang, I think it was Jimmy Riley, wee Jimmy sang, it was a Paddy Riley song,
Paddy Riley
to his mum in the hospital, all the nurses listening, and wee Jimmy's in the end of the bed singing this wee song to his mother, and then she died, and I just thought it was lovely. I mean, that's, maybe it's different now, you know, there probably are a lot of men footballers would still do that for their mums, but it struck me as a generational thing, you know, like my parents, your parents,
a common touch,
decency, and he was there for his mother right at the end and all that stuff. And like we were mentioning, the wee boy, was it Thomas,
communion.
And coming up and phoning up Agnes and bringing communion up. And I think, if my memory serves me from the piece, I think Thomas was a childhood friend and used to put a ladder up to the window Jimmy's house, and Jimmy would sneak out the window and they'd go play football together. and that relationship continued throughout his whole life. With Thomas was still there, and Thomas brought him communion and all that kind of thing. But
there's a story when Jimmy died, it was I took the deal for, because I wanted to go to the funeral, and when I said a funeral, I mean I wanted to stand at Celtic Park with the rest of the fans, just to pay my respects, but I just felt it was the right thing to do. A private thing, I just went myself, it wasn't any big deal, I never took anybody, I never told anybody particularly about it, but it was a freezing cold day, and I stood there for about an hour and a half, and eventually the funeral cortege passed by, and you know, everybody was, I think some people were clapping, and it was really nice and respectful, and again, it's quite a humbling thing as well, and I felt sad, felt really, you know, I don't know, it sounds crazy, but and I don't say this lightly, because my mum died 2 years ago, it felt like as if one of the family
of course,
died,
in a
greater sense, in the Celtic family. So I went back, and I went into the bath to get a heat, I poured myself a bath, and I got into the bath, just even hot bath, which is great, and I heard the phone going, I heard my wife on the phone, and she shouts in, just on at the bathroom door shouting, that's my dad on the phone, she said, did you get him the order of ceremony for Jimmy Johnson's funeral? And I'm like, what? She said, did you get him the order of Jimmy Johnson's funeral? I says, do you think if I stood in the call for an hour and a half, I says, I wasn't at the mass anyway, but do you think if I got one, I would have given it to your dad? I'm being humorous, I don't mean that in a certain way. Why would I give that to your dad? I says, no, but, I was perplexed, what are you talking about? So it turns out that somebody had dropped it through his letterbox. And to this day, he doesn't know who did it. It wasn't any of his family, it wasn't any of his neighbours, it wasn't any of his pals. But somebody went to that and actually into the church where they give out it's a beautiful brochure.
Yeah.
It's got a drawing of Jimmy in the front, and inside it's got all the hymns. And I'm sure it was St. Patrick's Day, because Hail Glory St. Patrick was one of the hymns that the words there. And he gave it to me, right? Because he was a collector, that kind of thing. But, and it would mean a lot to me, and I'm like, John, you must know who gave you it. And even to this day, me and him will sit down, and I'll say to him, do you know who gave you that yet? And I say, it must have been an angel that just dropped it through the letterbox or something. Because it's just mysteriously appeared.
Mysteriously, aye. Well, I mean, you know, with Agnes, it was just listening to her talking about him when he passed away was almost a beautiful thing, because she said he used to call her Biggin, and I think he was saying, Biggin, I'm no well, you know, as in, I think this maybe, you know, and I think we'd gone upstairs and she was, you know, whatever, put him to bed, and it's obviously a very private thing, and maybe laying down beside him, she said, you know, I could feel the breathing changing and stuff, and blah, 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 and she said, and that was him, he just passed away. But it was lovely just, you know, as I say, remind my mum and dad, and just listening to, it wasn't Jimmy Johnson, the footballer, that was passing away, as it would be for maybe us. It was just Jimmy Johnson, that was my man, you know, and I thought it was lovely, and she was great.
But that's a terrific, you portray that so well in the book, and as I said, I'm not fair to admit, you know, I was nearly great in mind, you know, it's quite emotional.
Yeah, and, well, as I say, it was emotional for me, even going over there and listening to her, you know.
So, I mean, your dad was, you paint him as being physically strong.
Aye.
And I think also that he must have been very strong spiritually to endure what he's came through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my dad, in terms of religion and spirituality, you know, religion was very, very, very important to him. The stroke he had was really, really serious. It was really bad. The best part of 6 months, he was in hospital. He's got no mobility and he can't talk. So for me, for him to, 15 years later, he's in a chair, he's in bed, he gets lifted, the nurses come in, they put him in a hoist. It's not very dignified for him. He gets put in a hoist, he gets put in his chair, he sits there all day. You know, we'll take him out when we can, but it's very difficult because his size, he's a big man. So he's physically endured an awful lot, but mentally, spiritually, I think that's been the thing that's kind of really, really kept him going. You know, he was a man of faith. You know, that was his thing, and his faith, his religion was important to him. So I think that's helped him through this whole journey, and it's been a pretty tough journey.
So, in terms of yourself, then, is there any future projects coming up?
Well, I've just finished what I call a novel, but I suppose it's not. I've written a manuscript. I don't think it's a novel until somebody's actually going to publish it as a novel, and we're hoping to get it published. It's called The Boys of Glenview Falls, and it's actually got football in it as well, and it's about sort of three. It's loosely based on. A fictional account loosely based on, let's say, my grandfather who died at war. Mm-hmm. It's about a son going back to visit the grave of his grandfather in France. The war grave. Mm-hmm. And then through various things that I won't go into because I don't want to give too much away, but he ends up meeting his father in the war, and it's the dynamic because the grandfather is actually only 30 and his son is an older man, so instead of, you know, the dynamics have shifted, and it's but the crucial thing is that the son knows when his father's going to die. Mm-hmm. and what does he do about it? Can he change it? Mm-hmm. You know, and if he does change it, how does that impact in his own life later on? Mm-hmm. You know, if he saves his father, does that mean the knock-on effects?
Yeah.
He might not meet his wife, he might not meet his son, you know, might not have a son, a daughter.
He might not meet them.
So there's all that dynamic. And within that, there's a fictional team called the Glenview Harp. So there's a football scene in it. So, so that's the writing project I'm working on.
So would your grandfather have a war grave?
He's buried in Bayou, and we were over that. We took my father over.
So your dad got to see it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. Myself and my brother, was it 2 years? Two or three years before my dad's stroke. Mm. I think it was a couple of years before. So we got him over, and he's buried in France. And, you know, it's strange, he's been buried there for 50 years. More than that.
40
years. Because
it struck me he'd be one of the unlucky ones. He died near the end of the war.
Yeah, but not only that, and this is, for me, it was so poignant, and I don't know whether my dad knew or not, but so I looked into my grandfather's death, and he was in the tank division, you know, and I always thought, well, you know, he was killed, mm-hmm. you know, as happens, and many men were. But there was a really difficult part of the war, and my grandfather actually got through two or three days of this really bad bit. A lot of tanks were blown up, and this mm-hmm. and the next thing. But it turns out, and I found out through the Scots Guards, who my grandfather was in, that he got through that bit with some other men, and they were having a day or an afternoon of rest, as it were, before mm-hmm. they moved on to the next bit. But they were actually killed while they were outside their tanks by a shell from their own side.
Oh God, friendly fire.
Friendly fire. Oh, it was either Americans or British, we don't mm-hmm. know, but you know, you go all that way and then mm-hmm. but these things happen, and that's war, and there's no niceties, and so it was interesting to find that out, and I found that out mm-hmm. by doing the book. So
coming up to date then, and getting back to the Celtic then, what's your current feeling about the Celtic team and Ronnie Dyla's methods?
You know, I have to say I'm a fan of it. It was a really interesting appointment, totally left field, didn't see it coming at all. I have to say that, you know, according to reports, he was getting looked at as a number two, and it might have been really Keane,
that's right.
I'm going to be honest with you, and I don't think Keane was a man for Celtic.
Well, we dodged a bullet there.
You know, I think we did. You know, look, I think the guy was a phenomenal player. Probably a decent manager. Could be, will be, I think he will be. But I don't think he was the right guy. So when Dahlia came in, I thought, it's an interesting appointment. Mm-hmm. I liked it. And Celtic are quite smart. You know, Peter Law can be quite smart. They're looking at things long term. I think we've got to change the way we do things now. You know, mm-hmm. the you can't pay big salaries for players or managers, you know, that kind of thing. So we were taking a chance with somebody that's, well, we're getting paid a decent salary, but we'd have paid a lot more if we went to a manager in
England. Absolutely.
So I think his remit's coming in, you know, a bit more dynamic, a bit faster, you know. I like the pace of the team. I love the two young boys that he's brought in from the D&I.
They're good players, aren't they?
You just look at them and I think they're, you know, and maybe Celtic should have, I think it's Scottish football was doing this for a while, was going and trying to find an answer abroad.
Yeah.
A lot of good Scottish players here, and those two boys, from what I've seen so far, are brilliant.
Mm.
And who's the young boy? Johansson.
Yeah.
I think he's absolutely terrific. The guy's, his engine is ridiculous. He's just up and down that pitch like you wouldn't believe.
His energy levels just to be seen to believe.
It's from the start of the game to the end of the game. He's a different player, not as hard, but in terms of energy and that kind of thing, I go back to Brian Robson, who was just
mm-hmm.
a machine from box to box, and it just went constantly. So I like what I see now. Mm-hmm. And of course, a bit nervous at the start, you know, the European games and that kind of thing, and Rangers not being there, how that changes the dynamic, that maybe the calibre, a lot of people said the calibre isn't there anymore, but actually I think the rest of the Scottish teams have really pulled their socks up
mm-hmm.
and they're really giving Celtic a game here.
Something's happened to the team since the new year, I don't know, something just seems to
something just clicked.
Because there was that game against Ross County around about Christmas, New Year period, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm going, this isn't working here. You know, the whole formation thing, it's not going into detail, it's just no, does it seem something's missing? And yet, literally since the first game after the break, there was a click,
and
it seems as if everything's there. And fate's a funny thing as well, because the two guys that he's brought in, that formation, he's playing that 4-2-3-1, they're bored of playing that formation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's terrific, because there was a few players, I'm thinking of like Charlie Mulgrew in midfield and all that, and you're thinking, he didn't quite fit into, you know.
No, he's not. For a midfield, for that position, for what he's trying to achieve, attacking going forward, first of all, physically, I think he's too big for that position to play that position. I just don't think he can play in that.
Cumbersome. He's too cumbersome.
Yeah, you know.
Charlie's a defender.
Yeah.
A good defender, I have to say.
But I think you talk about click. I think it has, and the boy Armstrong and young fella,
Gary Stevens, GSM.
Terrific, just terrific. What I love about, you know, I think that he's doing the right thing, because what he's saying is, he's saying, look, play football, just play. We forget that. We always say, it's called football. It's the ball at your foot. Right. That's what it is. It's play with it.
It's actually quite a simple game as well.
You know, and it's a simple process. game, and you know, the old cliche, the cliche central, but make the ball do the work. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anybody on a pitch, any player, run faster.
Yeah.
I've never seen any player run faster than a football, you know? So you just got to push it about, knock it about, and what is it? That's it.
The other thing I like about Daniel is he's becoming a cult personality. Because he seemed in the beginning quite an introverted guy, and he's Scandinavian guys, aren't they?
Yeah.
Really showy and flashy. And yet, see this thing with Ronnie Roa?
Ronnie Roa.
Right? Right. And my boy loves that. Yeah, you know what I mean? And it's the way that the fans go,
and he gets louder and louder, and the big roar goes off.
And there's a Rangers fan in my work, and he says, what's that thing about after that semi final when you beat us? All the roars at the end, I said, you just don't get it. I said, that's what you call, I said, that guy's so in touch with the supporters, more so than any manager.
He's done is, he's embraced it because he doesn't know the sort of the club, the culture, as well as a natural, O'Neill and Lennon and people that have an affinity with the club already. He didn't have that. So he's taught himself, he's learned it, he wants to know it, he wants to understand it. Mm. And what makes us, why is there these fantastic fans? Why is it all these amazing things going on in the ground? So he's become part of it. And I think he's adapted really well, and he's been quite strong, because there's been a lot of criticism, not just Celtic fans, but non-Celtic fans as well, within the media, quite rightly. You know,
the press have given him a hard time.
I think with Andy coming in, he'd get a hard time, but because it's a guy that's from maybe a league that wasn't so strong, they're going to have a right go at him and say what you're made of. But I think he's really come up and says, well, you know what, I'm studying this game 24/7, I'm going to make Celtic a success, I've got a real idea of what I want to do, you know, and that click thing, I think he's, you can't make it happen in a month.
The thing I would say, you know, as well is,
6 months, it starts
Remember at the beginning he put a lot of play on fitness?
Yeah.
Well, I have to confess and say, there was a point where I thought that was maybe a red herring to cover up for the deficiencies elsewhere. I look at that team since New Year, and you think the Inter Milan game going late in the game, even Inter Milan with 10 men, we never buckled, we never wilted, we were still going strong at the end. And it's so noticeable when we play against the SPL teams, like, we're on the feet of them.
Well, that one in particular, Milan game, down to 10 men, I don't think the game changed. Celtic never at all. They never dropped at all. If somebody went in and watched it, they wouldn't have necessarily said they were a man down. They just played the exact. They were brilliant. They were absolutely fantastic. And I do think, I mean, I'm maybe it's an old fashioned thing, I think fitness is a thing we don't do properly in Scotland. And you have to be.
And you can be a professional footballer in this country. I don't think Neil, I mean, I have to say this, I don't think Neil Lennon's teams were unfit.
Yeah.
But it's noticeable that even the big English teams, when they get into the European stage, The continental teams are faster. It goes like that. You know, their quickness of thought, their quickness of movement, the way they move the ball, the way they adapt to tactical changes.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what Ronnie's trying to bring
to think, have that mentality to play that game and play that every game they play, and it becomes second nature. But I think he's doing a smashing job. And the Aberdeen game at the weekend. Of course. You know, this idea that Aberdeen, I think, are terrific just now. People are surprised at maybe the way Aberdeen came out. Look, every team's entitled to play well against Celtic. That's their job. It doesn't surprise me at all. I think it was what Celtic did was, they took a lot of pressure, soaked it up, thought second half and said, okay, we're going to adapt to the way they're playing, they're attacking us, and then boom, 4-0. It was absolutely, that second half was just phenomenal. It was 4-6. I mean, Gaudetti probably should have, you know, there's a bit, I don't know what was going on at the
two
end
or three
there.
Times it was getting annoying
in circles.
Aye.
You know,
it was
a wee bit silly. But it was great, and it's great to see Aberdeen doing what they're doing. Just
no, to be fair to Aberdeen, to give them encouragement, I don't think Aberdeen losing to Celtic was a particularly bad result. What was a bad result for them was drawing with Dundee and St Johnstone in the last month.
Absolutely.
No, that was 4 points that they blew because they drew twice. Now, those 4 points would have got them back 3 that we took off them plus 1, and they would have still been in the hunt. So losing at Celtic Park wouldn't have been the be all and end all.
That's
they'd
right.
still have been in the mix.
Yeah.
But you have to say that if you're drawn to St Johnstone and Dundee, that's no championship winning
for them. Yeah.
And I think if there's a disappointment, they should look at that rather than look at getting beat themselves.
That's right. Mm. But no,